Okay, we are just approaching 7:30, so I think we can go ahead and get started. So we're about to start the session. Welcome all to this week's Q&A session. Guests, as always, are welcome. If you want to join, there is a link that has been pasted into the chat, where you can go on our website to join up or send your family and friends so they can join up. And I will now mute all. As always, you do have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment. Please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. Later this evening or tomorrow, the PDF of the deck, the auto recording, and the contents of the chat window will get posted to our website, courtesy of all the hard work by Alan. And with that, I'll turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. We have quite a lot of material tonight, so we'll see if we can get through it and still leave some time for ad hoc questions. And you remember last week that we were asking what things would interest you. And during the meeting, there were a bunch of suggestions made. And then subsequently, some more suggestions came in by email. So here's a list of things that we're looking at, and the things that are in red and struck out are either going to be dealt with tonight or they're in progress somewhere else. But if any of these topics appeal to you and you'd like to make a brief presentation to the group, then they are available. So one of the suggestions was artificial intelligence for a monthly meeting. Somebody's interested in notifications about Bluetooth on a Pixel phone, various things in terms of handling digital photos, saving them, finding duplicates, etc. Finding the best default settings for a smartphone camera, synchronizing bookmarks across browsers and different machines in particular. Somebody wants to know which smartphone apps people find useful, whether there's a real-time translation app. Don't know what language is between, but I guess any translation app would be of interest. And how do you identify online threats to children? What are the things to look for? In addition to that, where do I find programs such as Windows accessories in Windows 11? Is it safe to delete everything that this cleanup lists? Is a VPN needed? How do you set up and manage your Google Groups and Google Drive? Saving passwords and the process of auto-filling forms in browsers, how secure is that? And the final item here, are apps and programs actually different? And so if any of those things you want to chip in on, let us know and we'll be happy to accommodate you. So going back to that suggestions for smartphone apps, I just remind you that we have had quite a few apps covered in past presentations in a Q&A. For example, an email program, K9 Mail, was one of the programs in our series of smartphone basics. Tom, in his Tom on Android series, Tom Trottier, included an app on mapping. And Stuart, in his Stuart on Android series, included, for example, Gas Buddy, how to find good prices for gasoline around the city that we live in. So the question really is, what do you find useful in terms of apps for smartphones and tablets? And what are your favorite things? So let us know and we'll try and do something with those suggestions. Okay, so moving along, we had a question came in. I guess it's one of the ones that we're covering. Multiple firewalls, Chris.
Yeah, one of the things I actually really like about Q&A is if I decide that I'm going to pick up some question that came in and do a little bit of research on it, Almost inevitably, I find out some information that I was not aware of, and such was the case with this. So the question came in from Carol, who I believe is on the call tonight. Yep. Do firewalls interact with each other and disrupt the operation of the other one somehow? So next. So it really comes down to an idea, do you have multiple firewalls on different devices or multiple firewalls on the same device? So we'll start off with multiple firewalls on different devices. So this is actually a good thing. So this is firewalls on separate physical machines. So typically what this will end up being is firewall on your computer and a firewall on your router. And in such a case, there's no conflict at all because they're actually operating completely independently, so they're not going to interfere with each other. It's an additive effect. So the way firewalls work is on a blocking basis, really, is the way you should look at it. So if one firewall blocks it, it's not going to get through to the next firewall. So you will add up all of your blocking rules as it comes about. So how firewalls act at the sort of basic level. So let's take a look for an example at inbound traffic where you have stuff coming from the internet and you have your router and a computer. So the router firewall goes through its rules first. So it'll see if something matches the rules, such as an example here of block all traffic from a specific IP address. You know, or if it sees traffic that matches what's known as a stateful inspection rule, such as a ping of death. So this is not matching to a particular IP address or protocol that's being used, but it's just something that the firewall will look at the actual traffic and determine that it thinks it's malicious traffic and then kill it. So an example of this is a very, very old one, ping of death. And somebody discovered that if you sent a ping packet, which is just a way of saying, are you alive out there? You send a ping packet and it replies, yes, I'm alive. They could craft a special ping packet that would actually crash the computer. So that's obviously malicious traffic. Nobody would actually want that on their network. And so a stateful inspection firewall would block that particular traffic. So in cases like that, the traffic will get blocked, that specific traffic, nothing else. Otherwise, the traffic is allowed through and it's passed on to the next hop, which in this case is going to be your computer. Then the computer firewall goes through its rules. And if it has any blocking rules that match, they will block the traffic. Otherwise, the traffic will be allowed to go onto your computer and do whatever it was going to do, render a web page, bring in an email, or whatever the traffic was designed to do. So that's how the firewalls act in concert. Next. So now let's look at multiple firewalls on the same device. So conceptually, and this I actually thought that there was no problem with this. So conceptually, they should be able to coexist. So firewall one, whichever one, will apply its rules. It might block some traffic and allow other traffic. The other firewall will apply its rules, and it may block some traffic and allow other traffic through to the operating system or the programs running on your computer. Turns out that most people actually recommend that you only use a single firewall on any one physical device. And I give the URL down at the bottom of there, and it's also pasted into the chat. So the statement from that webpage was, running two firewalls is not recommended by most security experts due to severe crashes and internal system collisions. They go into no further detail about whether this is actually something that will always happen, may happen, anything at all, why it would happen. I really assume that what it comes down to is you have two firewalls running in your computer. Basically, they're both going to be trying to look at the traffic before it gets passed on to anything else on your computer, including another firewall that might be running on your computer. So it really comes down to which firewall gets to see the traffic first and then pass it on to the other firewall, and then it passes it on to your computer. So it might be similar to not running two on-axis antivirus programs on the same computer, which is a real no-no. Because, again, they're fighting to get first access to it, and typically your performance will go to the toilet. So I'm guessing that that's why, but it seems to be that the recommendation is on one physical device, only have one firewall running, unless there's something that is specifically stated that it's safe to run with other firewalls. Next. So the recommendation is run a single firewall on every device on your network. So your router will have a firewall in it. It will be on by default. Probably a good idea to verify that it's what firewall is actually running. And it will give you pretty good inbound protection for every device on your network. By default, they don't do anything about outbound traffic. So the router firewall just lets all outbound traffic go. Then you want a firewall on every device on your network. And I say device because it's more than just your computer. So it can be your phone, TVs, your refrigerator, whatever it is that has a connection to the internet. So it will provide protection for that device alone. Because they're installed right on that specific device, it can actually provide protection from other devices on your internal network. So if I have my, you know, I used to, one of the biggest reasons why I ran a firewall on my computer was my son ran his computer inside the network. And so I wasn't protected by the router firewall. And I didn't trust my son's computer. I don't know what the heck he's up to on it. So I wanted to protect myself from his computer. Okay. So that's a really big reason to have a firewall on every device on your internal network. And then there's some protection on router firewall that could be either difficult or impossible. For example, block all traffic from winword.exe, which is the executable for Microsoft Word. Well, you know, when it gets to the firewall that is in the router, it can't recognize that specific traffic came from winword.exe. It just sees that it came from a particular computer. It's going to a particular computer. It is using certain ports. That's the level of information that it has access to. Or how about block all traffic when no user is logged in? So you fire up your computer, you don't log in, you just leave it at the login screen. Well, if you have malicious software that's on your computer, it could actually be running in the background before you even log in and doing whatever it was designed to do, including talking out on the internet. So the router firewall isn't going to recognize that there is no user that was logged in, but you may want to have a rule that no traffic is allowed to leave your computer if there is no user logged in, maybe. Or block all traffic to Pornhub.com if the logged in user is Johnny. You know, so you could do something on the computer that could just say, you know, I just want to have, you know, certain traffic that gets blocked if it's a particular user that's using the computer. And I think personally that there is no reason not to run a firewall on all devices on your network. Your call, but personally I think that you should look long and hard for any reason not to run a firewall. And that's okay.
Thanks, Chris. So whoever's interested in real-time translation, Micheline's put an interesting link in the chat. Skype now supports real-time video call translations with your own voice. So that's kind of an interesting way to do it. Very specific to Skype by the sound of it, but an interesting possibility anyway. And Chris, Tom is here, so if you want to make him a co-host, he's going to.
Okay.
And Tom also notes that Windows Firewall Control makes it easy to control the built-in Windows firewall. That's a third-party app, I think, that he talked about a while ago. Okay. One of the other questions that we had was, how do I share video files? For example, recorded Zoom presentations. I wonder what that is. Maybe tonight's Zoom presentation? I found that video files are too large to send by email, and can I use Dropbox or any other cloud storage provider, I guess, come to that? And I refer you back to, I think this was a fairly old review of Dropbox, which I did in the newsletter. But basically, it was talking about how to use Dropbox to do exactly that. And it's really useful if you have big files like videos, or you have a lot of smaller files, a whole bunch of photographs, which by the time you're sending 20 photographs, you essentially have a great big series of attachments. And often, email servers won't let you send attachments over a certain size. So it's more useful to transfer them over the cloud using something like Dropbox. And typically what you can do is, if you have a video file, you can share a link to that file, and only the person who gets the link really can access that file. Or alternatively, you could share an entire folder, and actually that can be a two-way street. You can allow people to edit files in the folder or add files to the folder, download them or whatever. So it's quite a useful technique to have. And anybody who's got a Google account, you have access to Google Drive. So you have cloud storage available for this purpose. Okay, one other thing, disappointing news. I updated Macrium Reflect, the disk imaging program that I've been using for several years. I updated it to the November the 26th update, I think it is, and came across this notice that said that the free edition, which is the one I always use, is being retired. And there are no further updates as of November the 26th this year. However, there will be patches available for 2 years, until January the 1st, 2024. But as far as I'm concerned, I think it's time to move on. And I'm going to be looking at one of Chris's articles on ESUS to do backup, because I think that's the one he uses and thoroughly recommends. So I've already downloaded the software. I'm going to be trying it out pretty soon.
Alan, before you do that, I mean, you're going to get patches for another little over a year. I personally would wait and see, because they may find that rather than going to their paid version, all the free users are just going to abandon ship and go to some other free program. So they may reverse course on this. So if I were you, I'd wait for at least a few months to see if they all of a sudden say, oh, mea culpa, we're going to have a free version available again.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah.
But I'm certainly going to try out ESUS in the meantime.
Yeah. For in the meantime, I did paste into the chat the four programs, all four programs that I reviewed in the article I had, Finding a Backup Program, and there are still free versions as of today for all of them except for Macrium Reflect Free. And so, all of the other ones, they are crippled a little bit in some fashion, but they're all extremely capable backup programs.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And Chris, we're coming back to you now because you promised people that you would cover Send Reduced Light.
Yeah, it's a program that I find to be kind of handy, and Linda uses it a lot, and she really likes it as well. So this overcomes the problem of sending photos from your phone or your tablet, and the problem is that photos can be very large. Okay, so I have an example here of my phone, a Google Pixel 6. It puts out 12 megapixel images, 4,000 by 3,000 pixels in size. The average JPEG that comes off my phone is 3.6 megabytes. That was over about 500 different photos. And the range of file sizes was from 1.5 megabytes to 7 megabytes in size. So they're not inconsequential when it comes to size and sending them around by mail. People might not appreciate their mailbox being flooded with large files. So a lot of people run near the edge in terms of the amount of space that they have available, and it gets to be a pain in the butt if all of a sudden you can't send mail or things like that. So the solution is to reduce the size of the photos before they get mailed, and that's where Send Reduced Light comes into the picture. Next. Now, just a note here that some phones, especially the high-end flagship phones, they list having very high-resolution sensors, as high as with Samsung S22. They have a 108-megapixel sensor, and you might think that, oh, wow, if a 12-megapixel sensor can have 7-megabyte files, then something that is 108 megapixels, are we talking about over 10 times the size of that? So 70 megabyte files? No. Because all of the phones that do have these high megapixel sensors, they actually do what's known as pixel binning. And it combines data from either 4 or 8 adjacent photo sites into one. And so they all output 12 megapixel images. So you should never see any phones out there currently that are creating JPEGs that are larger than, you know, averaging around 3.6 megabytes and ranging from 1.5 to 7 megabytes in size. Next. So you can get Send Reduce Light at the Google Play Store. And I posted that into the chat. And when this is something that goes beyond just the Send Reduce Light, but whenever I'm downloading something from the Google Play Store, these are sort of things I look for beyond the functionality. Is first off, how many times has it been downloaded? And in this case, Send Reduce Light has been downloaded 50,000 times plus. What's its star rating? So what are the users who are actually using this program think of it? This gets 4.3 out of 5, and it's over quite a few reviews. It's 576 reviews. So that's probably pretty representative. I look to see what's new. And what that will tell me is how often is this program actually being updated, and is it in active development? This one has gone through from version 0.2 to 0.28. So they still haven't come out with a version 1 yet. But it does seem to be under active development, and it was last updated July 19th of this year. So getting a little bit long, I would have expected, you know, probably to see more updates, but it's not all that sophisticated a program, really. And so I don't see that it really is going to need a lot of updates. Next. And then the last thing I do is I check the written reviews. I take them with a grain of salt. But if you happen to see a lot of the reviews complaining about a specific issue and that specific issue is important to you, then you might run into that same aggravation. So it's worth reading the reviews to see if anybody has really bad things to say about it or if everybody loves it, whatever, to help you judge whether you really want to install this program on your phone or not. Next. So the default settings for Send Reduce Light, there's two settings that you have to be concerned about, and one is the maximum resolution, and it defaults to 1024 pixels, and the JPEG quality, which defaults to 85. I'll come back and talk about these more in detail later on, but for me, I think that most people, those are reasonable settings that will give you good quality images with a good deal of compression. And later on, I will go into why some people might want to look at those settings and adjust them to their needs. Next. So there's two ways to use the app. So the first is that you can go and find your photo in whatever app you have that looks at photos on your phone. Typically on Android, it'd be called either Photos or Gallery or something like that. And then usually you'll have a share option on that. And you click, tap on the share, and then it'll come up with your email. So the other way of doing it, and I'll go into that in more detail. The other way of doing it is to start your email first and then attach a photo to that. Next. So one thing of note is that sending by email is just one way that you can send it using Send Reduce Light. You can also send a text message, but if you use a text message, you can't actually start with the text message and add an attachment. You have to start with the, your photos or your gallery or whatever, share it from there and choose text message, and it'll work in that direction. Next. So let's look at it doing it from the Photos app. So the first thing you do, you find your photo in the Photos app or the gallery app, you tap on share, next. And then rather than saying you want to share this by email or text, what you do is you choose send reduce light. So you tap on that. And then you tap on how you want to send the photo. So it'll be you're handing off this sharing to send reduce light. Send reduce light is then going to reduce the photo, and then it will send it how? In this case, I've selected K9 mail. It could be text or Gmail or whatever. Next. And then it dumps you into your mail message. Whatever you did, I did K9 mail, so it'll open up a new K9 mail email, and it'll allow you to compose it. So give the to, the subject, your message text, and your photo will be attached automatically. Note that in this case, I had a file that was 2.7 megabytes or something like that. It is now going to send out from 2.7 megabytes, it's reduced it to 174.7 megabytes, or kilobytes. So significant reduction. And we'll look at a little bit on the quality that you end up with next. So the other way of doing it is sending it from the email. So if you start an email and then you tap on the add attachment next, and then when you are offered where do you want to get this photo from, rather than getting it from Drive or your photos or gallery or whatever, you will have an option there, get reduced light rather than send reduced light. And so you tap that. And then you say where you want to get your photo from. And in this case, I'm going to get it from photos. So I tap on that. And then I go find the photo in my photo gallery app and then select it. And then it'll dump back into the email with it, again, reduced to that 174.7 megabytes from the original 2.7 kilobytes from the 2.7 megabytes. Next. So let's look at the quality. So look really, really closely at this. So this is the original. So it's a 12 megapixel photo, 4,000 by 3,000 resolution. Now, nobody's looking at this on a screen that is displaying 4,000 by 3,000 pixels, I'm sure. But so it's being compressed down so that you can actually see it. But that's an original 2.7 megabyte. Now, watch carefully, and Alan will hit next. And did you see the shocking reduction in quality? So this is with the defaults of the JPEG quality of 85 and the maximum resolution of 1024. So it has gone from a horizontal resolution of 4,080 down to 1024. So one quarter of the size horizontally and vertically. And the file size is now 175 kilobytes, 6.5% of the original file. Next. Now, if you zoom in, you can actually see in this, and it might be a little bit hard for you to actually see, but I tried cropping in on the original and then comparing it to the reduced copy. And if you look really carefully, you can see some artifacting on some edges, particularly rounded edges and things like that. But in reality, these are so close to the quality. I see a comment shows in the hair. Yep. I mean, there is some artifacting that goes on. Now, if that bothers you, either send reduced light is not your candidate, or later in the presentation, I'll say how to adjust so that you don't get as much artifacting. Next. So it's no problem if – I think it's no problem if the recipient is viewing the entire photo on a computer screen. I mean, the resolution on a computer screen is just such that you don't have to worry about it. So when might the recipient need more resolution? Well, the send reduce default send reduce, if they need to print the image, you're going to want to give them a higher resolution image. Okay, if you want them to have the additional quality, that's up to you. Or if they want to zoom in on just a small portion of the photo and take a look at it, or if they want to edit the image. You always want to give people who have to edit the image the maximum pixels to work with to begin with. So this is a zoom in on the send reduced image, the 0.78 megapixel image. Next. And here is a zoom in on the original 12 megapixel image in the same area. And you can see there's a lot more artifacting going on when we start zooming in and eliminating a lot of the image. Next. In those sorts of cases, I would highly recommend that you send the full res to the recipient, either by email or through Dropbox or Google Drive or something like that, because they're going to appreciate getting a higher quality image for sure. Next. So fine tuning. So this is where I talked about what the defaults were and how you might want to actually change it. Next. So the maximum resolution, you could choose anything from 256, which would be really, really a lot of artifacting going on, right up to 2560 pixels on the longest edge. So you can choose any of those that you want, and next. For JPEG quality, you can choose anything from 60 to 100. Those are not magic numbers by any stretch of the imagination. They don't really mean anything. The lower the number, the lower the quality, or the more compression that ends up in the JPEG file. The higher the number, the less compression that happens to go on, and less artifacting you'll get. Next. So let's look at the resolution first. So you can reduce the number of individual pixels that will make up the image to any of these values for the long edge. Now, one thing of note, photos will never be made larger. So if you select 1024 and your image only has 500 pixels, it won't actually make it bigger. It'll just send it off on that. So it'll only do reductions, no sizing up of things. Next. So again, how's the recipient going to use the photo? If they're just viewing it on the screen, think about it. A high definition monitor, 1920 by 1080, it's only 2 megapixels. I mean, that's not an awful lot of pixels, you know, especially when you're talking about coming from a 12 megapixel phone image or something like that, or higher if you're sending it from somewhere else. A 4K monitor, you know, it has 4 times that number of pixels, so it's getting up into the 8 megapixel, but it's still not an awful lot of pixels. So is there really any point in sending a 12 megapixel photo to somebody who's going to view it downsized to 2 megapixels anyways? I don't think so. So next. So my recommendation is choose somewhere between 1024 and 2048. You get an awful lot of compression, as we've seen, just at the default 1024. So you might just want to leave it at that. If you want a little bit better quality, if you find that little bit of artifacting is bothersome, you could bump it up and you'll get, you know, larger files, but you'll get less artifacting. So in this presentation, I use the 1024 default. Next. So the JPEG quality, it reduces, whenever you save with JPEG, it reduces the file size by looking throughout the photo and it throws away fine detail. So in a sort of nutshell, what it'll do is it'll look and it might see, 20 pixels all side by side that are very close to the same shade of green. And JPEG might say, okay, I'm just going to call it one color of green and I'll call them all the same. And then I can just say, I've got 20 of this green pixel rather than listing out 20 pixels. So that's basically how it goes about doing the JPEG quality. Next. So if you get below 85, you will get increasing artifacting, but you'll get much smaller files. Next. Around 85 or 90, you'll get very little noticeable degradation in quality, but you'll get really good reduction in the file size. And next. Above 85 or 90, I actually don't recommend that anybody actually use that. You will get very minor noticeable change in quality, if anything. So you might get slightly better quality. Most of the degradation in qualities that we saw in the example actually came from the resolution downsizing rather than the image quality. And you will get dramatically larger files. In actual fact, a lot of times JPEG will actually get larger files. If you set it to 100, the files that are output will actually be larger than the originals. Next. So again, my recommendation, leave it at 85, or if you want to, experiment with your photos and see if you want to reduce or enhance that number. And again, in this presentation, I just left it at the default of 85 for all of the examples that I had. Next. So we have Send Reduce Lite, but there is Send Reduce Pro. And so what do you get if you actually pay your money for that? Well, really what you're doing is you're supporting the developer. The cost for SendReduce Pro is $1.29 Canadian at the Google Play Store, so it's not overly expensive. What you actually get is pretty minor. Okay, so what you will get with the Pro version is the ability to choose a file name, so you can actually put out whatever you want as the file name rather than an example here, which is a real example of what it actually output. If you don't care about the file name, then Pro is not necessary for you. And it also gives you the ability to include EXIF information. So this is metadata that's tagged in the file itself. Things like, you know, the GPS data, the camera model, the aperture was shot at, the ISO was shot at, things like that. The light version strips all that information out, which some people actually prefer to send it with stripped information. But if you want to send it with EXIF information intact, then you'd have to get the Send Reduce Pro for the princely sum of $1.29 Canadian, which I presume is one of the typical things of pay once and any updates will come free. And that's it.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And I think that's not working. Great. Sorry, I'm trying to switch. Slides. Yeah, that one isn't doing what I want. I thought I could hit the number and it would go to it.
If it's got the focus, you hit the number and then enter.
Oh, there we go. That's not the right slide.
You got to hit the right number, though.
I did. There we go. All right, sorry. Just a little technical glitch there. All right, so Tom has promised us to talk about PopFile, which is a Bayesian email classification system. So, Tom, I believe you're going to share your screen now.
And unmute yourself.
Now I'm unmuted. Now to share my screen. And that's the screen. Okie dokes. You can see it. So
yep.
This is PopFile. Pop stands for Post Office Protocol, and it's the standard way to for email programs like Thunderbird and Pegasus and other programs that you run on your machine to access an email on another computer that's being stored there. PopFile is a Bayesian email classifier, and Bayesian means that it's this it's a statistical method of classifying things. It's math. I don't understand it. And what it does is it updates emails with additional headers or a subject update, which you can then easily filter by your email program. And it basically, it learns from mistakes because you tell it when it makes a mistake, and it says uh-oh, and it fixes it for future classification. It's quite accurate. It basically works as a proxy on your machine for reading emails. In other words, your email program, instead of accessing the foreign email server, it accesses PopFile, which then accesses the foreign email server. And it does support secure connections. Excuse me for a moment. Okay. So here's what it looks like. These are the classes that I use. And zero list, one RV, two fraud, three subaccounts. And you may notice that each of them begins with a different character. This makes it easier to choose later on when you're correcting things. But these are the buckets, so you can basically use any name and create any number of buckets. The ones that come up that people really like are things like scam. Whoops. Things like spam and fraud, virus, fraud's up here. But there are a variety of other classifications. These are all correspond to folders in my email program. You can also use magnets to mandate a class. So if it comes across a particular word or a particular address or a subject word, 2 or CC, so if you're getting an email from your boss, you want to always put them in your work folder, for example, even though it may classify as something else. You always want it to go to a particular bucket. So those are magnets which are correspond to which make it change right away, rather than having to go through the classification and coming up with the wrong classification. In the configuration, there's a variety of things you can choose: history view, module options. I access it on 1990 locally, but it doesn't matter because you can choose to have it not be accessible by people outside. But the variety of other things that you can choose, these are the ones I use. For security, I want it to be stealth mode. In other words, I don't want anybody outside this machine to access anything on POP file, using POP file. I don't have a password. I'm the only user on this machine, and I don't think anybody else will want to change it. And you can check daily for updates, but it hasn't been updated since 2015, so don't bother. And I have this sending statistics daily, but I don't know where it goes to, since the getpopfile.org site has gone away. Popfile is not only no longer being updated, but you can't get it from the official site. You have to get it from archive.org. And in advance, there are a variety of parameters you can fiddle with if you want, but I don't touch them. The thing that I do touch is here in the ignored words. You want to add words that you figure will not make any difference in the classification. In particular, my company, Abicurial, abicurial.com, Yahoo, Banner, Base, etc. There's a lot of stuff put in there to start with, but I put in the ones that refer to me, to my email or something like that. So those are where you would add it. And what this POP file does is it adds headers to your email. In this case, it adds these three headers. I'm not sure what the placeholder is for, but you get a next text classification, which in this case is 5 computing, and you get a next POP file link, which is the link when you get to a local computer, port 9090, you jump to message and view that message. It will allow you to view it. I have it set to keep the messages for 8 days. And then after that, the messages get deleted from POP file. And the way they show up on my email program, which is Pegasus, is I've specified that Pegasus put them up at the top here. So the PF class is 5 computing, and the PF link, PF being POP file, is blah, 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 97532. And it was this message here. So this got categorized correctly. It's in my 5 computing. And I can click on the PF link when POP file got it wrong, and POP file will then update its corpus of words so it does better next time. In other words, you click on this link, and then you choose what is going to be the classification that it should have. So in conclusion, POP file can classify emails pretty accurately into many classes or buckets by the words they contain. If you use email on your machine, not webmail, then this may help you, especially if you're on many email lists, and it'll classify them, all the emails properly. When it is wrong, you correct it and it learns. It was last updated, but it works with Windows 10 fine. It's available at this address. I've chosen the one right after 2015. So you can get it there, and that's the original URL, the original domain that is currently not active, that has disappeared, although apparently the server is there, but they don't recognize this particular domain. Are there any questions?
I don't see anything in the chat.
It does not work with webmail. It works with email on your machine like Thunderbird or, I suppose, Outlook. I haven't played with Outlook, but I believe that's online. That's local as well, or can be.
Okay, thanks, Tom. And moving along, we have another follow-up from Chris.
Okay, let me just paste into the chat. Okay, so let me find my files. Okay, so sharing from Google Drive. So this is a question that was or a subject that was suggested. And how do you go about sharing a file on Google Drive? So I'm looking at it from the perspective of going on the web-based of sharing your Google Drive. So you go to drive.google.com. You can browse all the files that are on your Google Drive. And then if you want to share it, you first off select the file and click on it, and then you will get an option in there that says get link. And so when you do that next, you'll take that link and you'll send it to the person that you wanted to share that particular file with. Now, the default is that when you say get link, anybody you send that link to will have read access to that file. They won't be able to modify it. They won't be able to delete it. But anybody who has access to that link will be able to open it up. So if you send it to them, then the recipient clicks on the link, their default browser will open up, and the file will open up typically in Google Docs. Okay, so if it's a file type that is recognized by Google Docs, such as a Word document or a PowerPoint file or an Excel file or whatever, it'll open up in Google Docs, which can sometimes actually be a problem, and I'll deal with that in a second. So fidelity can sometimes be less than ideal. So they will understand the Microsoft file formats, but they don't necessarily show them with full fidelity. And so the recipient may need to have a copy of that file on their computer rather than viewing it in Google Docs. Next. So the recipient can download a copy. So while they're in Google Docs, there will be a menu bar. And if they click on File, Download, and then there'll be the list of file types that it can copy this file to, and you just choose the file type that it is. And the trouble with doing this is extra steps that you might have to tell people in order to have them be able to save that file and, you know, onto their computer. And so that can be a bit of a pain to make sure that they understand how they can actually get a copy onto their computer rather than just viewing it in Google Docs. Next. Now, in order to get them so that they can actually download the file by default rather than opening up in Google Docs, Stefan at the Q&A on just over a year ago, he actually showed how you can take that link that will be generated by sharing that file or giving that link and changing that link so that it'll actually be a download option rather than coming up in Google Drive. So you can go through and do it that way, but there's a much easier way, and that was the impetus for actually creating this particular presentation. Next. So there is an awful lot easier way of doing it, and that's to use a web service. So I pasted this into the chat, and basically what you do is you start out the same way. You share the file through Google Drive, and you get the link. Next. And then what you do is you go to that URL, and it'll come up, and next, it'll prompt you for your URL. So you paste that link in that you got from Google Drive, and then you click on next, the create direct link, next, and then it will put out an output. And if you just click on that field, it'll actually automatically copy that to your clipboard. And what you do is you paste that into your email to your friend instead. Next. And when they click the link at that point, the default browser will open. It'll automatically come up with a save as. Doesn't even show them the file or anything like that. It'll come up with the save as dialog box. They'll be prompted to save the file. They can save it on their computer, and then they can open it normally on their computer. So a really, really nice way of forcing it to be a download rather than viewing it on the website.
And there is a comment in the chat that says another easier way is just to use Dropbox.
True.
Dropbox basically generates that download link automatically, so you don't have to go through that awful process.
Yeah, I know. It is terrible what Google has done. In a way, it's terrible. If you want people to just be able to view it and, you know, they don't care about having a copy on their computer, it's not necessarily a bad way. But it's just that it sort of forces you through that, which is a little bit annoying. The one counter to using Dropbox that I would say is you only get 2 gigabytes of space for free on Dropbox, whereas Google Drive will give you 15 gigabytes for free. So if you've got a very small amount of information, very few files, then it's not a bad idea to use Dropbox or any of the other file sharing services. But if you are like me and use up a fair amount of space, Google Drive is a better option, just space-wise, and using this web service will make sure that it's always a download link that you send to friends.
Chris?
Yep.
Can you go back to one of your first slides on this topic? I just had a question about when you were showing how to do the original link.
Yeah, okay.
So, as you'll recall, a couple of weeks ago, I was trying to share some files on Google Drive. I typically use Dropbox because it's so fast and easy, but I was sharing files on Google Drive and it did not automatically set it that anybody could view who had the link. I had to give someone permission to view that link. So just to give people a heads up, if somebody can't view it, you have to go in and when you do that, when you right click on that file and say get link, there'll be an option that may or may not be set to everybody who has the link can view it, and you might have to give permission.
That's interesting. I've never had it do anything other than
when I was sending,
default to.
You were there, yeah. And I was sending. And Manfred had to write me to get permission. Because
Carol in the chat, Carol says that she's received Google emails that says she doesn't have permission.
That's right.
Obviously it does happen.
It does happen. It does happen. So just if you, it's not necessarily the default that everyone who has that link can view the file. If you do get an email message requesting permission, you have to go back in and open that Git link and make sure you click on everybody who has the link can view this file.
Okay, the other thing you could do rather than the Git link, if you do the option above that, is share, and that'll bring up the dialog box where you can actually change whatever the default is on your system.
Okay.
And so there you can actually just make sure that it's set to anybody who has the link can open the file, and then you can get the link directly from that dialog as well.
Right, okay.
Okay, good, thanks.
Yeah, and the other issue is, using Google Docs. That's a horror show when it comes to Microsoft files, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Chris. I have to skip forward again now. We're at the witching hour, and we just went by it. No, there we are. We're at the witching hour. We're in the last 10 minutes, so this is our time. If anybody has any additional questions or comments or things that you'd like to share with the group. It's basically open season.
Alan, if I could just slip in one quick comment.
Sure.
When Chris was showing the Google Play Store and how to look at ratings and that, I never realized this till, I know it sounds stupid, but I don't mind being the idiot in the group. I never realized till last year that you can actually, I used to always scroll through the comments and see, oh, this was a good one, this was a bad one. You can click on, say, 2 out of 5, and it will just show you the bad ones, or 1 out of 5, and it just shows you the really bad ones. So if you want to be more efficient when there's 556 reviews, you can click on it by the rating. So I found that really handy.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a default or what, but I think that the most recent reviews are at the top, and that is usually what I want to concentrate on, because if I get a review that is 1-star review, but it's for a version that is 2 years old or something, it might not be relevant. So keep that in mind too. But yeah, if you want to look for, you know, what do people think is really bad about this,
yeah
that's a really good way of going about doing it for sure. So, okay.
Comments in the chat. Talking about sending large files, Jeff says another good way is to use sendthisfile.com, which sounds like it's an online thing where you just upload one file maybe at a time.
And most of those services have an additional charm in that they only keep the file there for a specific period of time, and then it just disappears. So it could be a good or bad thing. But check if you are using one of those services to see if it does expire it automatically, and make sure you let the recipient know that pick this up in the next 2 weeks or something like that if they do expire the file after a period of time.
And Stuart had said that he mentioned this before, but www.ioxtalliance.org, Internet of Things, ioxtalliance.org, has a list of certified safe Internet of Things devices you can use behind your firewall.
Cool. Carol asks, she says, no, they've presented many topics before. Is there an index on the website or just search topic? Right now there is, it's separate pages for each of the years. So if you go to the archive listing, you'll have to go into each of the years and then search within that. We don't have an overall topic index. If anybody wanted to take on that as a project, that might not be a bad idea.
Aaron wants to take that on as a project. I had them all listed in one huge web page, but it was just getting longer and longer, and I had dozens of photographs in as well, so it was a really big page. So I decided I would break it up by year, thinking that Mr. Google, in his wisdom, would go and index everything, and then we could just use the search box on the website, or just use Google itself and look for things that way. But it turns out you can look for stuff and Mr. Google won't tell you it's there. And I don't know why that is. I was talking to Bridget, the webmaster, about it just recently, and it seems as though it's real hit and miss. Some things it will list and some things it doesn't. So I think I'm going to have to go back, and just so I can find stuff that we've talked about previously, and create a file that has all the lists of things, and then that will be, I'll post that on the web, and you can download it, and it will be searchable. And who knows? Google may even index it. You never know.
Just because there was some confusion over the sharing on Google, just in our last couple of minutes, I'll show an actual example here. So what you're looking at now is my Google Drive on the web. And so if I wanted to share, for example, this focal length compression version 3.docx, so I can right-click on it. And what I was advocating is just saying get link. But because it seems like some people are getting links that are not shareable, you're probably better off going with the share option here. Then you can share it with specific people. Now, those specific people, it has to be a Google account, because that's the only thing that Google can use for authentication is a Google account. So that could be a Gmail address is automatically a Google account, or people can have other email addresses that are, in effect, Google accounts. But you have to do it through a Google account. Or what you can do is come down to this section here, general access, and only people with access can open. Oh, actually, this is interesting. It looks like this is defaulted to restricted. My experience had always been that it wasn't. So you would come into here and say anyone with the link, and then you could copy the link, and then you paste that into your email or whatever. So it looks like maybe Google has changed the defaults on this at some point in time, because I used to do it all the time of just copying the link, but it looks like you're best to come in through the if I just click the done. So again, right-click on it, and rather than get link, come in through share. And make sure that this general access is set to anyone with the link, or you have to know the person's Google account. Thank you, Linda, for pointing out the error of my ways.
No problem. My job.
Hey.
Okay, so we're 2 minutes to go. I'll let you put things in the chat we can deal with later on. But in the meantime, let me just tell you a few things. I just want to remind anybody who's already a member of the club, please don't send us any money. The board of directors, in their wisdom, is extending everybody's membership by an extra year. You will not receive a renewal notice. We are not going to demand payment. And please don't send me money, because then I have to try and ask you how you'd like it refunded or whatever. And if you're not a member, as Chris said earlier, if you do join right now or any time before March the 31st, you will become a member in good standing as of March 31st, and then your membership will be extended along with everybody else's. So for low annual membership fee of $20, you're actually going to receive 2 years of membership for the price of one. So this is our infamous, famous, worldwide renowned two-for-one deal. And the final thing I have in to-dos is, you may recall that Lawrence, or maybe you don't know, that Lawrence is not going to continue as a member of the board of directors. Lawrence has taken care of the program for the monthly meetings and club publicity for a number of years, so thanks to him for that. And if you're interested in joining the board, Bob Harris is the election chair, and you have until the 31st of this month to put in your nomination. Okay, so upcoming meetings. In January, you have the dual evil person brigade, myself and Chris Taylor, who are going to give you our thoughts on what are the best things to think about when you're buying a personal computer. So that will be on January the 11th. That will be our regular January monthly meeting. But before then, next week, January the 4th, Wednesday, we have a regular Q&A session. But don't forget that we want your questions and topics to share. But we'd also like your suggestions for meeting topics and Q&A topics. And now we're asking for suggestions for apps on smartphones and tablets as well. So any of those things, get in touch with us at suggestionbox@opcug.ca. And final thing, on behalf of Chris and I and the entire board of directors, it's coming up to New Year, so we wish you a very happy New Year, and we'll see you in the New Year next Wednesday.
And I can guarantee you there is one item on the agenda already, because I just realized why the links that I used in Google Drive were always shared with anybody who had the link. And I will give an updated presentation on how to achieve that and some other things you might want to consider when you're using Google Drive to share files with other people.
And you're going to tell people how to share things by Dropbox too, right?
Well, I can point to how Alan shared a folder with me, and we use it to collaborate on the Q&A stuff. I don't use Dropbox myself. Okay, thanks a lot, folks.
Really well.
Yeah.
Thanks, okay, folks. Good night, everyone. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.